Ladies and gentlemen, the chair would now like to recognize Mr. Lester Coe for purposes of introduction. Lester?
Former Virginia Governor Charles S. Robb is currently the chairman of the Democratic Leadership Council. He is a graduate of the University of Wisconsin and the University of Virginia Law School. He holds honorary degrees from 14 colleges and universities, including Washington and Lee. He was elected Lieutenant Governor of Virginia in 1977 and became the Commonwealth's 64th governor in January 1982. During his term, Robb served as chairman of the Southern Governors Association, chairman of the Democratic Governors Association, and on the executive committee of the National Governors Association. Extremely active in Southern politics, Robb served on the Southern Growth Policies Board, the Southern Regional Education Board, the Southern States Energy Board, and the Appalachian Regional Commission while governor. He currently serves on the Commission of the Future of the South. A distinguished lawyer, Robb began his legal career in the U.S. Court of Appeals in Richmond and then became associated with the Washington law firm headed by Edward Bennett Williams. Following his term as governor, he joined the Richmond-based law firm of Hunt & Williams. And let me tell you, folks, he made every effort to get here. He flew in by chopper, through rainstorms, around mountains and everything, and we're really happy to have him here. So please give him a good big round of applause, Governor Charles S. Robb.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right. All right. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, President Wilson, my old friend Governor Clinton, many other distinguished guests, and especially convention delegates. I am delighted once again to be able to join you. And I'm delighted to be associated once again with this prestigious and nationally renowned event. I remember 4 years ago, the mock convention was staged during a rather emotional debate over co-education at Washington and Lee. That question now resolved, 1988 marks the first time that state delegations include women who are actually W&L students. And I congratulate all of you on this latest improvement. Consider it another step toward realism and authenticity. And speaking of realism, I note that you haven't failed to include on the program some of the more convivial and festive aspects of political conventioneering. In fact, it makes me wonder just how far you'll actually go in your quest to be as genuine as possible. Given what I'm told is still about a 20-to-1 ratio of young Republicans to young Democrats on campus, I doubt if all of the delegates are real Democrats. And I doubt if all of your delegates are above the legal drinking age. So I assume that those weren't real cocktails that you were serving at some of the pre-convention parties. I didn't think so. But somehow the idea of mocktails just doesn't fit my perception of a W&L social event. I only mention it to remind you that it was under a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress that prohibition was repealed. Well, this marks the second consecutive presidential election year that I've had the opportunity to address the Washington and Lee mock Democratic convention. And I've got to admit to some mixed emotions about being here for my second consecutive mock Democratic convention, since you traditionally invite members of the previous election's losing party. It's an honor I would prefer that you reserve for some of your Republican brethren. And I hope I won't even qualify to be invited back in 1992. But come to think of it, maybe some of you would be happier with a mock Republican convention after all. At least your successors in 1992 would be able to stage a convention that's in tune with the political demographics on campus. And besides, I understand that my good friend John Warner just can't wait to return to the Beta House to see his old room again. This year's mock convention promises considerably more mystery and excitement than any in recent history. Not just one or two, but five Democratic candidates are still in the running, or at least still breathing, and the nomination at this point is anything but a fait accompli on the Democratic side. In fact, most of the veteran pundits nationwide are a little gun-shy by now and aren't at all sure what's going to happen next. And this convention's legacy of success in predicting the eventual nominee means the eyes of the political world are once again focused on Lexington this weekend. But while the rest of us wait anxiously for news of who you nominate, I hope, and I know you're going to address it shortly this evening after you hear from Governor Clinton, I hope that you'll also devote considerable time to another question. And that question is, what should the Democrats say to the American people in the fall campaign? What should we stand for? What principles and policies should we offer if we hope to win the general election? I'm going to ask for your attention, if I may. It seems to me that it's important that you discuss the development of a broad message and a common vision for our party and for our country, because it's our message that will decide whether we win the White House or spend another 4 years as the loyal opposition. And I would like to talk to you about that message tonight. I am convinced that this next election represents the Democrats' best chance in 12 years to win the White House. More than 7 years of Republican rule has left America restless, anxious, and apprehensive about the future. Americans want more than feel-good rhetoric about the future. They're ready to be challenged as a nation, as a people, to do better, to win the world economic competition, to advance the cause of freedom throughout the world, and to secure a better future for their children. More than a few observers have drawn parallels between this election year and 1960. An aging second-term president, an apparently prosperous economy, a world ostensibly at peace, but also a general uneasiness among Americans about the future and direction of our country. Some say the Democrats need a charismatic candidate to exploit this political climate, much the way John F. Kennedy did 28 years ago. But I would submit to you that many miss the point. I don't happen to believe that all the charisma in the world would propel this year's Democratic candidate into the Oval Office if his message, the party's message, is rejected by mainstream America. I don't believe we need the magic of JFK as much as we need his substance. A program of economic strength at home and assertive U.S. leadership abroad. This message laid the foundation for Democratic majorities and enabled our party to win 7 of 9 presidential elections between 1932 and 1964. Under Roosevelt, Truman, Kennedy, and Johnson, the Democratic Party merged the narrow concerns of our constituencies into a broad, progressive agenda for economic and social reform. And our position as the natural majority party empowered us to effect change. We experimented with government. We expanded opportunity and upward mobility. We tipped the balance of economic power from the privileged few to the striving many. And we gave ordinary Americans a greater stake in our free enterprise system and the defense of freedom. In doing so, we benefited our core constituencies, mostly working men and women, retirees and farmers at first, and later minorities. You know, many in our party speak wistfully of the days of the yellow dog Democrat, those who'd vote for a yellow dog as long as it ran on the Democratic ticket. It's an expression that also used to describe most moderate and conservative Southerners as well. Now, you've probably heard the old story about a Southerner who, when he was asked why he was a Democrat, replied, "Because my father and grandfather were Democrats." And the Northerner who said, "Well, what if your father and your grandfather were horse thieves?" And the Southerner replied, "In that case, I guess I'd have been a Republican." Now, these moderate and conservative Democrats, along with Democratic-leaning independents, were once a part of the bedrock of the Democratic majorities. But in recent national elections, we've learned how easy it's been to lose their allegiance and their support. The old Democratic coalition has withered in the perception of too many Americans into cloying advocacy groups whose priorities are often in conflict with those that are needed to fix the economy and promote widespread prosperity. Now, while there's certainly nothing inherently wrong with citizens banding together to promote mutual interests, these groups have attained a profound influence in our presidential nominating process. The result is that a once broad agenda appears to have withered into a series of individual litmus tests for candidates. And to the extent that that's true, the Democratic Party has been forced to break faith with its legacy. The party of experimentation and change is seen as becoming the party of the status quo. The party of economic expansion and universal opportunity is seen as becoming more concerned with protecting the few from unwanted change. The party of a strong foreign policy is seen as turning non-committal and isolationist. And the party which created the vast middle class is seen as turning itself over to ideas, causes, and values that are simply alien to most Americans. No wonder if that is the public perception that we have lost all but one presidential election in the lifetime of those of you who are delegates to this convention. We've lost our natural majority. Ordinary people who struggle to make a future for themselves and their children. They have become our forgotten constituency. I believe that we can bring them back into the fold in 1988. But we've got to speak their language again. We're probably going to have to go over the heads of parochial interest and go directly to the American people. We need to bring the Democratic Party back to its traditional moorings and let America know that we've regained our broad sense of national purpose. I believe America is ripe for the legacy and tradition of Democratic leadership. Leadership that emphasizes expanded wealth and opportunity over redistribution. Leadership that stresses America's role as a defender of liberty and democratic values throughout the world. And leadership that's not afraid to underscore the value of hard work, shared sacrifice, duty and citizenship to our national progress. I'd like to expand on that last point for just 1 minute. I believe that Americans do best when they're called upon to accept the burdens as well as the benefits of a free society. Now, granted, we're a nation of individuals. But that doesn't mean we ought to be self-absorbed and devoid of unity and national purpose. We cannot allow our collective responsibilities as citizens to fall by the wayside. Freedom has a price, and I believe we've got to be willing to defend it. And we've got to be prepared to give something back to the society which we share. That's why I happen to favor a new system of voluntary national service. In return for enhanced government benefits such as student loans and housing assistance, we would ask high school graduates to enlist in either the military or civilian service corps. Not only would we increase the reserve of manpower for our defense and social needs, but we would reward volunteers with benefits that help them climb the ladder of opportunity. They'd have the chance to help their country as well. This is the type of policy that I'd like to see the Democrats offer America in the fall campaign. Let's not simply promise growth without sacrifice. And let's not tell Americans that their chief obligation to their country is simply to pay higher taxes. Instead, let's offer them the challenge of citizenship and common cause. Rather than come out against everything the Republicans are doing, here's a chance for Democrats to stand for something. Democrats, in my judgment, ought to stand for this and for much more. Democrats ought to stand for doing something about our astronomical budget deficits, because they're mortgaging our children's future and limiting government's ability to meet current challenges. Democrats ought to stand for confidence in America's productivity and ability to compete, because protectionist policies would prevent the growth that we're going to need to raise our standard of living. Democrats ought to stand for compassion and human progress, because investments in people, education, and equal opportunity are the keys to upward mobility for all Americans. Democrats ought to stand for internationalism and not isolationism. For a foreign policy that promotes freedom and democracy the world over, from South Africa and South Korea to South America and Nicaragua. Democrats ought to stand for military strength and resilience, because weakness and vacillation will not keep the peace, nor will it defend our shores and our allies. Democrats ought to stand for ordinary Americans and not the parochial interests, because we need to reinvigorate our agenda, which has grown dogmatic and resistant to change. If a program doesn't work, we ought to fix it. This is the essence of the Democratic message I'd like to see our candidate carry into the general election. I believe that it is a message that can bring us victory if we have the political will, the good sense, and the courage to offer it. So I leave it to you, the delegates of this auspicious political and educational event. You've been wrong only once since 1948. If in the end you keep your streak alive this year, let it be said that you helped our party form the nucleus of a winning candidacy. Give us more than a candidacy, that deserves to lead the Democratic Party. Give us a candidacy that can lead America. Thank you and good luck.